Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Well, these days, Richard Feidler is best known for sitting down with guests to have very interesting but very respectable conversations. But back in 1989, he was living in London with his much less respectable comedy group, the Doug Anthony All-Stars. There he was singing songs and cracking jokes when suddenly revolution broke out in Europe. Ever curious, Richard hopped over the channel and travelled to Prague. He wanted to experience this moment of ordinary people rising up peacefully against the corrupt Czechoslovakian government firsthand. The protests became known as the Velvet Revolution, and although Richard eventually returned to London, the city that hosted the uprising never really let him go. So 30 years later, Richard returned to Prague to uncover the history of the city from its medieval origins through communism and the Velvet Revolution, and finally to its present and uncertain future. It was a journey he recorded in his new book, The Golden Maze, a biography of Prague, and he's going to be talking about it in tonight's literary event, which was recorded earlier this year in Sydney.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here. And just quietly, isn't it lovely to be out with other people? Particularly in this luxury hotel, the Four Seasons Sydney, as opposed to Four Seasons Total Landscaping in Philadelphia, where Rudolph Giuliani likes to give his press conferences. So give yourself a round of applause for showing up at the right venue, I think. Thank you for that kind welcome. This is my book. It's called The Golden Maze, a biography of Prague. It's a personalised history of a lovely, tragic, and profoundly weird city. For me, it's the most beautiful city in the world. It's a history that follows the story of the city from its legendary origins, through the Middle Ages, through the science and magic of the Renaissance, and then through the violent, turbulent 20th century, where the city fell within the grasp first of Adolf Hitler and then Joseph Stalin. It's a book that for me has been 30 years in the writing. The first time I came to the city of Prague was in the immediate aftermath of the Velvet Revolution, which people here may well remember. In 1989, I was living in London with the Scabrous comedy trio that I was a member of at the time, performing in a theatre season, and this was Europe's year of miracles, as one by one we watched the police states of Eastern and Central Europe fall one by one, the totalitarian dictatorship set up by Joseph Stalin after the Second World War. And this was deeply thrilling, but I was so close to it being in London, but so far, and I couldn't go because we had this theatre season. And by the time the Berlin Wall came down in November 89, I was jumping out of my skin, watching it on the BBC, seeing people dancing and drinking champagne on top of the Berlin Wall. So as soon as our theatre season ended, my girlfriend arrived in London and she and I went to Berlin and from there to Prague. And this is January 1990 at this point. And Prague was still experiencing the absolute fizz and joy and excitement of their own revolution, which was peaceful in its nature and non-violent and became known as the Velvet Revolution with all those faintly erotic overtones. I think I felt like I was in the happiest city in the world at that time. People were busy going from place to place, handing out handbills. There was spontaneous partying in the streets. I joined a demonstration against the secret police, which marched right up in the front of the secret police's headquarters, the headquarters of this notorious organisation known as the STB, where we shivered for a moment and wondered if they'd shoot at us like the secret police shot at the crowds in Bucharest only right before that had happened. There was a delirious atmosphere in the streets at the time. One night, my girlfriend and I decided we would go to the commemoration of a young man who self-immolated in 1969 at the protest, in a protest against the Soviet invasion of the previous year. His name was Jan Palach, and he self-immolated at the top of Wenceslas Square in 1969 in protest, and it was illegal to commemorate his death ever after. And this was the first time that the commemoration was legal. And so we went to the top of the square there, and there was this kind of wedding cake of melted candle wax and flowers everywhere, and it was all terribly moving and quite late at night. And two soldiers approached us. They would have been about 19 years old, I think, wearing heavy military greatcoats. And I knew very, very little Czech at that time, but I did know the word they were saying to us, which was pivo, 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 which is Czech for beer. Now, beer in Prague is, certainly at that point, makes the finest beer ever made in the world. And I thought it might be fun to go drinking with a couple of Czech soldiers. So I said, yes, pivo, pivo, come with us. Come to our hotel is here. Drink beer with me and my girlfriend. And he said to me, this young guy said, oh, America. And I said, oh, no, Australia. And he said, ah, Australia. He went, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide, Perth. I went, wow, do you know your geography? And he went, Australia, ACDC, ACDC, Angus, 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 and started impersonating Angus Young in the middle of Wenceslas Square playing air guitar, going, like playing, hopping across Wenceslas Square. And I went, that's great. And standing next to these two soldiers was this slightly creepy-looking dude with a comb-over and a briefcase who was looking faintly sinister, slightly like a secret policeman. And he was sort of smiling at us, and he went, Australia. He went, Kylie Minogue. Kylie Minogue. Lucky, lucky, lucky. And then he looked at my girlfriend and went, nice girl. Nice girl. So we took these soldiers drinking with us, and this dude with the comb over followed us, trailed behind us, sat at a table adjacent to us in the mezzanine bar of the hotel. And Jan, this young soldier, sat there with me, and they served beer. And like they serve beer in like these big glass vases, essentially, in Prague, which is a marvellous thing. And after one of these, Jan was a bit worse for wear, and he looked at me and he said to me, Richard, listen to me, please. We are friends, yes? And I said, yes, yes, we are friends. He said, please, Australia, Czechoslovakia, Germany, Poland, America. He said, one world, please, one world. And I said, yes, 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 Jan, yes. He said, no, listen to me, please. Australia, America, Russia. And as soon as he said Russia, the guy with the comb over leapt out of his chair, went bang onto the table and made the glasses jump and went, no Russia, not Russia, no Russia, like that. And he glowered at us, opened his briefcase, flung these handbills at us in sort of dense Czech language, which was completely impenetrable to me, and then stormed out. And Jan just looked at him and went, eh? Listen to me, please. Australia, Czechoslovakia, man, one world, please. And the reason why he was so overwrought was, I kind of realised it in a moment, because he was a soldier stationed right on the edge of the Iron Curtain. Now, it's often forgotten, but in the early 80s, the Cold War reached a new height of tension. And I came out of high school in the early 80s thinking I wasn't going to live to see 30. I thought nuclear conflagration was inevitable. I went to uni in Canberra, and we'd sit around saying, you know, if there was a nuclear war, would Canberra be bombed? Would it be a target? Or would we die 2 years later in a choking death from a nuclear winter? These are not good conversations for young people to be having. And so Jan, this soldier, he knew that had there been a nuclear exchange in Europe, his village in Moravia that he was from would have been obliterated. He would have been obliterated. His family in Prague would have been obliterated. And so there was this wonderful sense of joy and relief from people like him and in me as well. For the first time, we felt like we had our future given back to us. And I think this is a moment when I sort of shifted from being pessimistic about the future to being optimistic. So this was a terribly moving time for me. And on top of that, there was the loveliness of Prague. Prague, after 40 years of communism, was really grimy and run down, and there was scaffolding everywhere, but, oh, God, it was so beautiful, and it still is today. It was so uncannily beautiful as well. It had this kind of prickling strangeness to it. Walking through the city in winter at midnight, you feel it, this odd sense of apprehension, this sense of otherness and weirdness. It's like a prickling sensation at the back of the neck. It's something that many, many people have noticed coming to Prague. The writer Patrick Lee Fermor, in his book A Time of Gifts, he came to Prague in 1933, and he was completely enchanted by the city. He said that there were moments when every surface seemed to have the tip of a phalanx of inexplicable phantoms. André Breton, the poet and founder of Surrealism, came to Prague the same year in 1933 with his sidekick Paul Éluard, and they were taken by local surrealists around the city, and instantly André Breton grasped that the city's surrealist masterpiece was the city itself, this odd tangle of golden, winding streets. There's not a right angle to be seen anywhere in that central part of Prague whatsoever, and it has this odd, uncanny feel to it. So I'm just going to do a quick reading from my book here about how this led to the writing of this book. The origins of this book can be traced to the Velvet Revolution, when I found myself among the happiest people in Europe, revelling in the peaceful overthrow of a decrepit police state. It was one of the most exciting moments of my life. At the time, I knew something of Prague's 20th century history, enough to feel a shiver of dread as I passed by the secret police headquarters on Bartolomeska Street. But the origins of the city itself were a mystery to me. Prague in those days was grimy and tendril-like. It seemed that no human hand had been needed to construct it, that it had somehow risen up from the soil like a stone garden. Prague's history is dotted with extraordinarily ambitious people who have striven to touch the stars. In the years when Emperor Rudolf II ruled from Prague Castle, he gave his patronage to astronomers, alchemists, and magicians, hoping they might penetrate the inner workings of the universe and discover the occult correspondences that bind it together. Prague has also served as a playground for fanatics acting in the service of heaven, or someone's idea of heaven on earth. Nazis, Stalinists, and Catholic crusaders have all tried to bend human nature to their will and to eradicate whole categories of human existence. Those who blocked the road to paradise or failed to cheer loudly enough in the parade were executed in a prison courtyard or on the stones of the old town square, in the very place where tourists now gather to watch the famous astronomical clock chime the hour. The story of Prague offers a stark warning against the totalitarian urge, if we care to hear it. I once imagined that totalitarianism was a peculiar phenomenon of the 20th century, but Prague bears the scars of earlier murderous crusades that set out to win souls for heaven, led by men who dreamt they could straighten the crooked timber of humanity by striking it hard with a hammer. And yet, for all these monsters that have come to rule from Prague Castle or from an adjacent power, Prague has this amazing history of these extraordinary philosopher kings, and in one singular and an important case, a philosopher queen. And that's the story of its legendary founder. One of the things I love about Prague is that, like many cities, it has this legend of its foundation, but the founder is not a man, it's a woman. A legendary witch queen named Libusha. Now, there's no evidence that Libusha ever actually existed, apart from her name comes down to us from folk tales told and recorded 1,000 years ago. But it was said that Libusha founded the city of Prague by standing on a cliff one day overlooking the vault of a river that goes through Prague today. And she had the gift of prophecy, and she was said to have stood back and her eyes rolled back in her head and her arms came up. And looking down, she said, "I see a great city. Its glory will touch the stars." Then she turned to her courtiers and she said, "Go down into the forest below, and there you will find a clearing where there is a man making the best use of his teeth at midday. That is where we will found our city." So the courtiers did as they were bid. They went down into the forest below. They found a clearing where a house was being made, and two men were eating their lunch. But there was a third man using a saw on a block of wood. And that's where they'd found their man, making the best use of his teeth at midday. And they said, "What are you making?" And he said, "I'm making a threshold for a house." Now, threshold in Czech is Prague. And that's how Prague gets its name, Prague. The name itself means threshold. And for me, that's the most beautiful and poetic name for a city that is like Prague. Prague, for centuries, has served as a threshold where strange and troubling creatures of the imagination have come into the world. It's Prague where we have the legend of the Golem of Prague, this legendary monster made out of river mud put together by the great rabbinical scholar of the age, Rabbi Loew of the Renaissance era, to protect the Jewish people from the Gentiles who would periodically come into the Jewish quarter of Prague and massacre the inhabitants. It's Prague where we get the word robot. The first robots were shown on stage in a play written by the Czech playwright Karel Čapek in the 1920s, in a play called R.U.R., Rossum's Universal Robots, where he, for the first time on stage, created this idea of an artificial humanoid that humans turn to do all their work, and eventually the humanoids challenge them for supremacy. And the word he used for these humanoids was robot, which is a Czech word meaning forced labour. So the robot comes from Prague as well. And it's Prague where Franz Kafka wrote his famous short story, Metamorphosis, where Gregor Samsa wakes up one morning to find himself transformed into a giant cockroach. People who walk around Prague today see many of its great and beautiful medieval monuments, and there was one king in particular, a philosopher king known as Charles IV, who was the Holy Roman Emperor. Now, Holy Roman Emperors weren't very terribly Roman, not particularly holy in many cases either, but the Holy Roman Empire was, for much of the Middle Ages, a conglomeration of German and associated states, of which Bohemia, Czech-speaking and German-speaking Bohemia, was the most important state within the Holy Roman Empire. And Charles IV made Prague its capital. And it was Charles IV that commissioned the building of St. Vitus' Cathedral, that magnificent rocket ship of a cathedral that stands right in the middle of Prague Castle today. He commissioned Charles University, which was the first university in Central Europe, in order to bring a community of scholars into Prague to generate an exchange of ideas. And it was Charles that commissioned the Charles Bridge, that beautiful stone bridge that crosses over Prague. The stone statues came later, but he commissioned this magnificent medieval bridge, which stands today and is one of the glories of Prague. And there's a lovely story associated with that. Apparently, Charles laid the foundation stone for the Charles Bridge at a really specific date and time. It was on the 9th of July in the year 1357, and he did it at precisely 5:31 in the morning. And the reason for this is because if you get the numbers of the year, the day, the month, the hour, and the minute, and you string them together, you get a palindrome. You get 1357975531. Numbers that go up and down, and it was thought that those numbers formed a bridge which would lend the Charles Bridge some kind of spiritual, structural strength to the whole thing, which is a lovely idea. I mentioned Rudolf II. I'll touch on him briefly. Rudolf was one of the Habsburgs, and if you look at pictures of him today, he does very much look like a Habsburg insofar as the Habsburgs trusted no other family with power. So first cousin married first cousin for generation after generation after generation, double first cousins. And he's not a handsome man, Rudolf. I'll just put it like that, I think. But he was a brilliant character, shy, a terrible ruler in terms of running the Holy Roman Empire. He was terrible, but he again made Prague his capital. He was fascinated with the idea that the whole universe was like a puzzle created for us by God, and God in turn had given us all the power of reason, the power to unlock the puzzle. Like, here's the cryptic crossword, you figure it out, you have the power to do so. And he thought we were all obliged to do that. Because he was so terrible at being an emperor, he looked at creating shortcuts to power. And so he invited alchemists to Prague. He set up an alchemist workshop in Prague Castle in one of the towers that's at the end of the Golden Lane there today. And the idea was that these alchemists would find at last the means by which you can turn base matter into gold, creating a philosopher's stone which would do that. And because he was always in need of gold, this was really attractive to him. The philosopher's stone was also thought to have been an elixir of eternal youth. And Rudolf was frightened of death, so that was even more appealing to him as well. Now, of course, it doesn't work. But nonetheless, there was this underlying spiritual imperative to alchemy, which is really beautiful, which is the chemical wedding, the union of opposites within one's soul, to find the gold of the soul. That was the ultimate prize of alchemy. He also invited great scientists to Prague at that time as well. The great astronomers, Tycho Brahe, followed by Johannes Kepler, they studied in Prague. They were his imperial mathematicians. And it was in Prague that Kepler decoded the secret of planetary motion while in Prague. But he also attracted magicians, and it was a lot of fun to write about Dr. John Dee. Some people may have heard of him. He was Queen Elizabeth I's magician, and he's the model for Prospero in Shakespeare's Tempest as well. He came to Prague to give the Emperor a warning because he and his charlatan sidekick, Edward Kelly, had been communing with angels in a crystal. And they were dedicated to recovering the lost language of angels, which they thought would bring humans closer to God. So all this is going on in Prague before it's plunged into the 30 Years' War, years and years of struggle. And then we have the 20th century, which is this tumultuous period in Prague's history. At the end of the First World War, Bohemia, which Prague is the capital, had been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. It broke away after the defeat of the Austrians in the First World War. And a great philosopher king, another one, Tomáš Masaryk, founded the new country of Czechoslovakia. The Czechs joined up with the Slovaks and formed this new nation. The capital was Prague, and this is remembered as a golden age when there was a great flourishing of culture and art and democracy. It was a proper and genuine democracy. It had a protection for human rights. There were notable feminists serving in the Senate. President Masaryk himself was a feminist. He'd got that from his wife and taken her name as his middle name. Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk was his full name. And it became an industrial powerhouse at the same time, the 10th industrial power in the world, where we get a whole lot of brand names that are still familiar with us today. Bata shoes, Škoda automobiles, things like that. This was smashed by Adolf Hitler in the disgraceful compact known as the Munich Agreement. Now, that's been written about many times, about how the Czechs were sold out by the Western democracies, Britain and France. But I'm telling the story from the point of view of Prague, which had to watch themselves being traded like a plaything, handed over to Hitler, hoping that would satisfy him. And of course it didn't. And we know what happened. There's incredibly dark stories of the years of occupation under the Nazis. Adolf Hitler stayed the night, just one night, in Prague Castle. And there's the story of the great assassination of the evil Nazi, Reinhard Heydrich, who was shot dead, and had a bomb thrown at him in the streets of Prague during that occupation period. Then after that, the Soviet army invaded, liberated Prague, but then it fell within the Soviet zone of influence and became a pawn of the Soviet Union for decades. Many people here will remember the period that was known as the Prague Spring in 1968, that year of turmoil where revolutions erupted all over the world. Well, that happened in Prague as well. There was a reformist new leader of the Communist Party, a man named Alexander Dubček, who was a million miles different from his stony-faced Stalinist predecessors. Dubček was a decent man who allowed freedom of speech and freedom of travel, and this was unacceptable to the Soviets and Brezhnev, who invaded in August 1968, which is, of course, a fascinating and tumultuous time. I have a story in my book of that day by a broadcaster some people might remember, Yaroslav Kovaracek, who used to broadcast on ABC FM for some years. I knew he was an emigre who'd gotten out after 68, and I have his story in the book, which I think probably is the most extraordinary story I was able to glean in all of my research. In 68 and at other times, Pragers have characteristically used their brilliant sense of humour to mock power. Czechs are brilliant at this. They are the creators of this a wonderful book, which is like the Bible, if you like, of how to defy power. A wonderful novel called The Good Soldier Švejk, written by Jaroslav Hašek, which is a hilarious, wonderfully comic book. And Pragers are very, very good at taking the piss. They've done it for centuries now. During the Soviet invasion period, when there were Soviet tanks in the streets, the Czechs would do things like they'd rotate street signs 90 degrees to send tanks going down the wrong street. They were walking around with transistor radios glued to their ears, listening to the BBC and Radio Free Europe. And when police and soldiers confiscated these transistor radios, they went around walking with bricks of coal up to their ears. And when the police confiscated those, well, that created a lot of hilarity. 1988, the sign that society was about to return to normal again, there emerged a group called the Society for a Merrier Present, a group of young students who organised a militaristic march across the Charles Bridge. These young men had helmets made out of watermelons. They carried truncheons, which were salami sticks, and they held up banners, which were blank sheets with nothing written on them whatsoever. And so, you know, they were astounded bystanders, like, how were they able to do this? And when the police came and arrested them and confiscated the banners, people just fell about laughing. Like, what's so offensive in this message that you feel you need to confiscate the banner? And even today, the current president of the Czech Republic, a man named Miloš Zeman, is a controversial figure, to say the least. He's seen as being too close to Vladimir Putin and to Xi Jinping by a lot of people. And so a group of our terrorists invaded Prague Castle a few years ago, disguised as chimney sweeps. And yes, they called themselves art terrorists. They got into the presidential palace, got onto the roof, brought down the presidential flag, and instead hoisted up a completely gigantic pair of red silk underpants, which they said that Zeman ought to wear since he was a shameless human being and he was sucking up to Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping. And they even posed for an ISIS-type photo of themselves in all black with balaclavas holding up the red underpants saying, you know, we mean business. Pragers have always done that. They've always used humour to mock power and do it so effectively as a way of staying sane. I'll be taking some questions in just a moment, but I'm just going to read another part from my book here, which is a passage called The Ear. One of the things that's hard for us Westerners to understand about living in under communist Prague, under the communist regime, is the depth of surveillance that went on. I got talking to a woman during the Velvet Revolution who said, you can't imagine what it was like. Everyone was encouraged to spy on everyone else. And that would put you ahead of the queue to get an apartment or a car. And this was the point of it, was to break down trust between people. That was the whole point, because you need trust to form an opposition. And after the Velvet Revolution, when the secret police files were exposed, it turned out, of course, that husbands had informed on wives, sisters against brothers, best friends who'd been part of the dissent movement and found that their friend had been informing on them the whole time. Can you imagine what that's like, not to be able to trust members of your own family? And children grew up seeing their parents lie routinely to authority. What does that do to parental authority? One of the great miracles of the Velvet Revolution is that it was led by students who'd grown up in what great President Václav Havel called a morally contaminated environment, where they'd seen their parents encourage them to think one thing and say another. And yet despite that corrosive atmosphere of lies and hypocrisy, these students found this moral courage to stand up against the regime and lead the movement to overthrow it successfully and joyously, which is why I've dedicated my book to the students of 1989, who are my generation. The passage I'm going to read is part of a joke that was sort of told, and it takes place in the 1970s, after the Soviet invasion, during a period that they call normalisation, where everything was normalised, where this kind of grey pall, the dead hand of censorship and oppression, sat upon the city. This greyness, it was called at the time. But yet underneath all that, there was this passionate beating heart. There was an extraordinary rock band called the Plastic People of the Universe, which were not an anti-government band as such. They had no anti-government songs. They were just kind of psychedelic, wild and edgy, a mixture of the Velvet Underground and the Fugs and something, and Captain Beefheart. Yet the regime found them utterly intolerable, beat up their supporters, burned down houses where they did concerts in, and jailed some of their members. This was the pervasive environment at the time. But people who were part of that movement, who were writing stories, people who were part of the music scene at the time, it was an incredibly romantic and dangerous time. So this passage I'm writing about here is called The Ear, which speaks to the surveillance culture of the time, of the 1970s. Three apparatchiks came to Prague 1 month for a party conference. After the first day, they sat up late in their hotel room, drinking and telling stories. The alcohol loosened their tongues a little, and they began to complain about the secret police. One of them hushed the other two and whispered, "What if they're listening right now?" The other two laughed, so the man decided to play a joke on his friends. He went downstairs to the hotel reception and asked the woman at the desk to deliver 3 cups of tea to the room in 15 minutes. When he rejoined his friends, he sat down and he leant towards a vase of plastic flowers and said theatrically, "Hello, Comrade Major. Could you have 3 cups of tea sent up to our room, please?" His friends laughed, but when the tea arrived, they blanched, made their excuses, and went to bed. The next morning, the man went out for a walk, but when he returned to the hotel, his friends were gone. He asked the receptionist what had happened to them. "Oh, they've been arrested," she said. "They would have arrested you too, but the Comrade Major really liked your joke about the tea." The dread that one's conversation might be overheard was the subject of many jokes from this time. Some were long, shaggy dog stories. Others achieved a kind of pithy perfection. An American visits a Czech relative in Prague. "How are things going?" he asks. "Oh, you know," replies the Czech. "Can't complain." The secret police devoted enormous resources to keeping tabs on troublemakers. The dissident writer Ludwig Vatsalik and his wife Madla discovered tiny microphones hidden in every room in their apartment. Their phone was bugged, and another apartment in their block was taken over by STB agents to monitor their conversations. Thus, for 20 years, they avoided discussing anything of significance out loud and wrote it down instead on flushable sheets of toilet paper. Thank you. I'm very happy to take your questions now. Go right ahead, ask me absolutely anything. I can bang on for hours, I assure you. Go right ahead, ask me. Put your hand up if you'd like to ask a question. The gentleman over here.
Thank you, Richard. Really enjoyed the talk. And I've also read the book, and that was great. Really enjoyed the book. I was lucky enough a couple of years ago to be in Prague when the international so-called gymnastic convention was on. It originated in Prague, Czechoslovakia, as you know. And there's probably 30 or 40 countries in the world that were there, and it was fantastic. I understand that they're also heavily involved with keeping the culture going during these dark times and whatever. But I noticed it wasn't really mentioned at all in your book. Did you give thought to including Sokol in your book?
I did. I did think about writing about Sokol. Just as the gentleman said, Sokol was a gymnastics organisation founded by the Czechs, and there was a corresponding German one as well for German Bohemians, because society was quite segregated until the Second World War. And that was a very large part of Czech culture I think from the 19th century onwards. And under the communist era, it became a gigantic thing where there were huge displays of gymnastic prowess that were kind of a bit like North Korea. They've got this incredible Strahov Stadium in Prague that's the size of like 3 football stadiums. It might have been the biggest stadium in the world. And people would do identical gymnastic moves performed for the world's media as a display. People enjoyed it. Some people found it sinister, the idea of everyone hop-skipping and jumping together and doing gymnastic motions as one was seen as just a bit creepy and fascistic. I didn't write about it, no. There were some things I couldn't write about because, as you can see, the book is large enough and it's already heavy enough to stun a burglar with. And that's my definition of a good book, by the way. A good book is a thick book. But there was only so much room I had in the book to write about it. And it sort of dovetailed with a lot of overlapping themes. One thing I think the story of Sokol illustrates is that once the communist coup d'etat occurred in 1948, they called it a revolution, but really it was the Communist Party captured the police and the army. That's pretty much what happened. A new constitution was written which put party oversight over absolutely every single civic organisation. This was the sinister part of it. This is what the essence of totalitarianism, isn't it? Like, there were no more Boy Scouts. Instead, there were the pioneers. And there was always a secret police officer or a party official in charge or overseeing the things. Motherhood groups had been so plentiful until the communist coup d'etat. They too were disbanded or overtaken by party organisations. So the party had a role in absolutely every form of civic activity. And the Czechs are really good at this. They have been always good at these informal organisations, but the party sort of came and sat alongside them. You had a kind of a notional sort of quasi-parliament, you had a president, you even had a prime minister, but really the real authority in the country lay with the general secretary or first secretary of the Communist Party. That was the person who really ran it. I don't know if there was even a cabinet, but there was a Politburo, a party organisation. It was always the party, the party, the party. And the constitution affirmed the leading role of the Communist Party. And once there was the Velvet Revolution, once they could change the constitution and normalise the country, the first thing they took out, like a rotten tooth from that constitution, was the line that stipulated that the Communist Party was the leading institution in the nation, the guiding institution in the nation. So, yeah, I hope that answers your question in a roundabout sort of way.
Hello, Richard.
Hello.
First of all, I would like to say I love your conversation hour.
Thank you.
I'd like to know, how long did it take you to write this book, and where on earth do you get the time to write it?
I don't think I might have had one or two days off in about 3 years. I sort of work and work and work and work, I suppose. That's the thing in and around it. It took me 3 years to write this, which is longer than the other two books. The first one I wrote entirely, the second one I co-wrote with my friend Kauri Gislason. I just sort of found the time. I'm getting up really early in the morning. I can write on the bus as well, on an iPad. I just find the time to do it. I tend to get quite obsessive about these things. And to write history, you need to read absolutely everything. I just found the time. Having done the radio show, it's given me the ability to read quite quickly, to scan a document, pull out the nuggets of what I'm looking for. So that's certainly helped me. Doing the radio program, if I hadn't had the discipline of that, I don't think I'd be able to write any of these books. I took 2 months off at the beginning of last year. I received a writer's residency in Prague, which was wonderful, a UNESCO writer's residency. And they put me up in one of those Soviet bloc apartments for 2 months, which was kind of cool, because that's part of Prague as well. That has its own kind of creepiness to it, that side of Prague, the Soviet tower blocks, the Panelak, as they're called there. That helped a lot, and that's where I met some wonderful writers who I've mentioned in the book, like Marek Toman and other people. And being able to talk with them constantly helped a lot, because they all knew their history backwards, and that was a wonderful thing as well. Having 2 months off, I didn't mention it in the radio program, because it's not the sort of thing you can go on the radio and say, I'm going to be away, I'm going to Prague for 2 months to write a book. It makes you sound like a bit of a wanker. And so I just said, I'm just taking some leave, you know, that kind of thing. That's how I did it.
Richard, I won't ask you who you'd like to interview, but who would you like to interview again of all the folk that you've spoken to?
Oh, that's like asking if you've got favourite children, isn't it? I mean, you do have favourite children, but it's not nice to ask, is it? But there are a lot of people I like to talk to. The ones who make me laugh are the ones I enjoy the most, I think. The ones who are wonderful raconteurs. I grew up with a dad who was a wonderful dinner party raconteur, and I don't know, I just grew up learning to really enjoy sitting back and hearing a funny story. So I'm always looking for people who do that, who will do that. Yes. I think there's a gentleman down the front here.
Richard, I'm always amazed at the amount of preparation you go to in anything you do, whether it's on the radio or preparing your books. Is that preparation assisted by other people as well as yourself?
Yes, I work with wonderful producers and an executive producer.
In terms of
producer.
The research I'm thinking about.
Yeah, being the ABC, we're always hideously under-resourced, and it means we work around the clock and sometimes on weekends as well. But, yeah, yes, I that's the key, I think, if you're in broadcasting. The secret, if any good presenter will tell you this, is to treasure your good producers. Hang on to them. Listen to what they tell you. Ask them for advice. So, yes, working with producers is one of the real pleasures of that job. And writing a book is a little harder because I can't sort of say, what do you think of this? You know, should I say that? Or I can, but, you know, I don't want to load them up with more work than they already have. Yeah, producers. I work with wonderful producers. I'm really lucky like that.
Richard, you'll probably get this question many, many times, but why did you call your original group the Doug Anthony All-Stars?
I'd like to tell you, but if I did, I'd have to kill everyone in this room. Any more questions?
Yes. Hello. Me.
Hello.
Yes, I thoroughly enjoy your talks as well. In fact, I listened this morning with about cats, which I'm very interested in. But having said that, with Prague, now I visited Prague in 1990 and again in 2012 with my daughter, and I thought it was so overrun with tourists now. Do you think it's changed it a lot?
Yes, it has. Yes. One thing, even in winter last year, the place had so many tourists. The Charles Bridge was full of them. And I had really mixed feelings about all of that. On the one hand, it sort of loses that lovely, uncanny feeling when the place is filled with, you know, British blokes on a lad's weekend who are puking into the gutter, or people just sort of pushing around you all the time. You can still get that uncanny, weird feeling of pride, but it's sort of there late at night or first thing in the morning when the streets are empty. But, you know, I'm one of them, aren't I? Have I got a right to complain? You know, I'm one of the outsiders that's there looking around slack-jawed in wonder at the beautiful buildings and the cathedrals and everything else and the Renaissance and Baroque architecture. And it has led to an influx of money into the city that's allowed it to recuperate. There's a photo that was taken of me in January 1990 at Hradčany, Prague Castle, looking out across the city, and you can see the city is really grimy and run down. The roofs are bowing under age and lack of repair and all that. And a friend took another photo of me last year in this exactly the same spot, and the houses have all been painted, the roofs are all repaired. It looks really lovely, and thank God its heritage has been preserved. And a large part of that is with tourist money. But I missed the old communist shops in some ways. They were like the old communist shops that would sell nothing but like different kinds of mineral water. There were shops that sold like 10 different kinds of mineral water and sold as medicine, like, you know, well, this bottle of spring water from Karlovy Vary, that's good for gout. But this one here from Český Budějovice, you take that for indigestion. That was kind of nice. There was a shop I loved in Prague in 1990, which sold nothing but tiny, fake, leather-bound, square-like books of Shakespeare's sonnets in Czech, bookmarks and ex-libris slips. You know, things like that. That was kind of really cool. There was a chocolate shop I walked into that had like about 30 different kinds of chocolate, but they were sort of wrapped in this kind of really old-fashioned, funky sort of communist brands, you know, from Yugoslavia and Hungary and from wherever. And the chocolate was always completely inedible, but those wrappers were so cool. that was great. Now those shops are all gone, and they've been replaced by those touristy shops like we have in our main shopping precincts here in Australia, you know, like the ones here that sell plastic boomerangs and shot glasses and kangaroo paw bottle openers. Well, in Prague, it's a similar thing, except they sell little bottles of absinthe. They sell Matryoshka dolls, even though they're kind of Russian rather than Czech. They sell Franz Kafka tea towels, but not Franz Kafka's books, you know. So they're everywhere. But, you know, there's always something you have to put up with. I understand that since COVID struck and has emptied out the city centre of its tourists, there's been that's added weight to a growing movement within the city which says we are being destroyed by organisations like Airbnb and other temporary accommodation places. Residents are moving out of the centre to the periphery, and people from elsewhere are now living in these apartments as they come and go. And it's made Prague a duller place, and they don't want that to happen. We've seen that happen in smaller, beautiful cities all over the world. It's been happening to Hobart. It's certainly happened to Venice. I mean, what is left of Venice? Try and buy a hammer and a nail in Venice these days. You can't. Dubrovnik, Reykjavik in Iceland. It's deeply resented there, the hollowing out of the centre of Reykjavik. Shopkeepers like it, traders like it, why wouldn't they? So there's a lot of hand-wringing and angst over it. Vratislav Brabenets, who was the saxophonist in the Plastic People of the Universe, he swears at the tourists. You know, this is a guy who spent time in jail under the communists, but he said, oh, the tourists, they're just as bad as the Russian soldiers. They're everywhere. He's exaggerating, but not by much, I think. So mixed feelings is my answer to your question.
Well, I just wondered, did you end up being able to speak Czech to write this book?
Yes, fluently. No, sadly, no. No, it's the first time I went there in 1990, it took me like 2 weeks to master about 5 words. It's a difficult language for me in any case. I think for people who come from an English-speaking background. You know, when you go to like France or Germany or any of the Romance language countries, you can see like little bits, you know that informazione is going to be where you get information, that kind of thing. But English is a hybrid of old French and old German, and other bits and pieces. But Czech's a Slavic language, and it's much harder to grasp. So I learned how to say prosim, which is please, yukuyi, which is thank you, ano, yes, dobri den, hello, dobri večer, good evening, pivo for beer, yeah, I remember that. Oh, yeah. Pivnica, the place where you drink beer. I got much better at reading Czech language, though, much better at reading signs, understanding the diacritical marks that surround the language. So I got better at it, but no, I haven't learned the language. And these days, a lot of people speak English in Prague, in any case, in a way that they didn't or couldn't back in 1990. It's a difficult language, and it's Milan Kundera, the great Czech writer. He thinks this is one of the reasons why the Czechs have been left to their own fate by the Western democracies in the past. He says that the Western democracies have been held at a distance from the Czechs by what he calls our strange and scarcely accessible language. And there was that moment, that awful moment, in the lead-up to the Munich Agreement when British Prime Minister Chamberlain went on BBC and he said, how awful it is, how ghastly it is that here we are preparing for war, digging trenches and trying on gas masks, all in the name of a faraway people of whom we know very little. Now that's remembered today. They remember that. In 1990, when I was in Prague, someone heard me speak and came up to me and said, why did you do it? I said, why did I do what? You know, sell us out in 1938. Munich and all that. And I went, well, for a start, buddy, I said, I'm Australian and I'm not British. And secondly, my dad was a kid when all that happened. He went, you did it. You all did it, you know, like that, and walked away. It's remembered with a great degree of bitterness. The president at the time, Edvard Beneš, he just assumed that there was all this fellow feeling between him and the leaders of France and Britain, but there wasn't. And it's a great shame. Churchill saw it, Churchill felt it, but he wasn't in power. He was a powerless backbencher at the time. Yeah, so all that stuff is terribly poignant to see it today. And all you can do, I suppose, when they say, what did you do, is beg for forgiveness, even though you're Australian and you weren't around at the time. Well, I think that's it then. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for your kind questions as well. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.